Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the Gold Goats and Guns podcast for June 4th, 2023. My name is Tom Luongo and we have a lot to talk about. It is episode 145 and I have the great pleasure of catching back up with a friend of mine that I haven't had on in a while. And it bothered me actually the other day when I was thinking about this. Like, I haven't talked to Joaquin Flores in a while and it's actually something I really needed to do. And over the last couple of weeks with things flaring up between Serbia and Kosovo again and my community desperately trying to get me up to speed on this stuff, I figured if there was a better person to talk to in the public sphere than Joaquin about the importance of Serbia, Kosovo, the former Yugoslavia, it would be him. So, and since I'm going to be sharing a stage with Alex Craner, another guy I talk to about all this all the time in about 4 or 5 days, I figured I wanted to get somebody else into the mix on this. So Joaquin, good morning. How are you? How have you been? And good morning. Let's talk Serbia.
Yeah, let's talk Serbia. Tom, I just also want to say, yeah, it's been a while. I was thinking like, man, it's like, this. Where's you know, Tom at? And I mean, I follow your work, you know, but we hadn't spoken mano a mano in some time. And I always come away from my interactions with you feeling so positively charged. I got to come back for some more positive charge here. But I'm so glad and honored to be with you today. And yeah, I'm actually here in Belgrade, Serbia for the past more than a decade. So, you know, everyone, there's a lot of smart people. They disagree. I have my perspective. I can explain and argue it. It's I'm a very moderate kind of approach to it. So I hope I don't want to offend, you know, Serbs in the diaspora who are extra passionate about things, you know, diaspora effect. And I don't want to offend, you know, Albanians or anyone else. So I just kind of call it like I see it, just like a non-corrupt umpire in the Major League Baseball. So
sure. And I appreciate that. And that's what I've always appreciated about your work. And over the years of having read and interacted with you over the years, I've always said, you know, I might not always agree with everything that I'm reading, but I can't argue the sourcing. I can't argue the perspective. I can't argue the facts as they were presented. So, and that's always and usually it was a matter of, oh, it's ignorance on my part and that's one of the things that we're going to do today, because I really do feel woefully inadequate on this particular topic. So I understand that we have yet another flare up between Kosovo and Serbia. I think it would be a good thing just to remind everybody what the background on this is, and why NATO has such a hard on, in all practical terms, for why the Balkans are so very important and why they need to do this. And I think I have an understanding of it, but I don't want to color this conversation with my uninformed opinions at this point. And I really do mean that. So go ahead, take the floor.
All right. So there's like a couple different major approaches to the issue, you know, with Serbia and Kosovo, but I'd invite everyone from the beginning, if you're hearing this, if you have like a device near you, just to like pop open a map. And so you can kind of see where we're talking about exactly. Because first of all, when we talk about the Balkans and we talk about Serbia, because it's a Slavonic region of the world, you know, Bulgaria, you know, Macedonia, Croatia, you know, Bosnia. These are Slavs, of course. And the thing is that people make that connection to like Russia, but geographically, it's actually like just north of Greece and across that little tiny body of water, the Adriatic, from Italy. So culturally, you're looking at a region that's very much like Italy and Greece, as if they kind of, as if like Italy and Greece had a kid with the Turks and the Russians or something like that. So it's a very interesting region. It's really the crossroads of what they say where East meets West and stuff like that. Probably there's, you know, a scene or almost a scene in every other James Bond movie that takes place in Belgrade because of the importance of this kind of netherworld back in the old communist times, where Yugoslavia was like a communist state that leaned west, right? And so they were not part of Warsaw. They were part of the Balkans Alliance, which was actually part of NATO under Turkey. And it wasn't exactly NATO, but it was NATO supportive as connected to the NATO in the Balkans, right, with Turkey. And everyone I may know, of course, obviously about the breakdown in the 90s. But if that's, you know, we don't, that would be a whole show. But I think people probably have an idea. There was a war in the 90s here. You have these different groups of people. And fortunately, we're only have to talk about like two of the groups affected, the Serbs and the Albanian population in Kosovo. And just historically, well, that would be misleading. In the near history, the non-contentious history is that for, you know, since the end of World War II, according to the Yugoslav, you know, socialist constitution, Kosovo is part of Serbia. Serbia was part of Yugoslavia, and Kosovo was an autonomous region inside of Serbia. Even in the communist times, it was autonomous, which meant that they had their own Albanian ethnic government structures and stuff like that. Now, of course, one would say without arguing, but it would be an obvious fact that, of course, the Belgrade intelligence officials, you know, controlled the outcomes of certain things that were very important. But by and large, like in terms of the cultural, social, et cetera, distributive economy in Kosovo, like who gets what, et cetera, that was all autonomous. So they already had the a very high degree of autonomy, and they were the Albanian population, and they had a lot of legitimate reasons to want even more autonomy, you see. And that was something that Belgrade was not willing to do until they were like pressured to do it. And then, but the momentum that got Belgrade to recognize that Kosovo should have even more autonomy didn't need to end, because the British, working through the Americans, et cetera, didn't need it to end, right? In fact, it kind of helps if you can just take things to level infinity, right? So that's kind of how things began to, in the very, you know, fast forwarded, too long didn't read version, you have these legitimate claims from an Albanian population. The reason I don't go into the ancient history, I'm aware of it, mm-hmm. is that how much British and Smithsonian Institute stuff is connected to our understanding of antiquity, right? Where do original source documents exist? From the Renaissance, but everything before that was actually burned in fires or lost due to disintegration, according to every single leading Renaissance historian who transcribed those things. So we have question marks about these things, you know, not every single, but there's so many question marks about, you know, but by and large, it looks like Albanians represent like an indigenous population, a proto-Indo-European speaking population in the Balkans and Italy. So there may have been at some time, like maybe most of Albanians were Italians at one point in time in the south, southeast, central and southeast Italy, right? And you kind of have these two port cities that connect Albania to Italy called Bar and Bari. And you can look on a map and see them right there. Antonio Gramsci is Albanian. Monica Bellucci is Albanian, but we think of these people as Italian. So Albanians have made a fantastic contribution in all areas. It's, you know, they're everything is good, you know. Mm-hmm. And so according to the mainstream history, you have probably an indigenous Albanian population. And then between you had, of course, like Attila the Hun and all this stuff. So between the 5th centuries onward, you had these migrations, according to the official version, according to the British history, of Slavs into the Balkans or Slavic speakers into the Balkans. You had the Bulgarian migration from the Bulgars into the Balkans and the East Balkans. In the West Balkans, you had the Sorbo Croat people from perhaps the also the Volga Bulgar. Right there, you can see it, where the Volga Sea empties into the Caspian Sea. You will find 16th, 15th century maps that are reproductions allegedly of antiquity maps, with those problems I just mentioned for that reason, that indicate that Serbs and Croats existed as neighbors back then as well, kind of like maybe two different socioeconomic classes of a single group, even perhaps, or something like this, but we call them ethnicities today for weird reasons. And they seem to have moved then into what is now East Germany and spoke a language more similar to Polish today than Serbian. And then you have groups of them, of those Bela Croatians and Bela Sorbians that moved into the occupied or settled in the Dalmatian, in Dalmatia, in the Dinaric Alps, in the lands of today that are Croatia, Serbia, and Bosnia, Macedonia, and Montenegro. And so over the years, there's been wars, the Turkish, the Ottomans, blah, 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 blah. We can like fast forward to the 20th century, and there's kind of bad blood, but you always have the great powers, the Russians, the Ottomans, the English, all have their kind of interests in kind of antagonizing these people. Otherwise, they all kind of eat the same food. They really dress more alike than not, et cetera, kind of like the implicit cultural norms are far more similar at different times in history than we might think. Yeah. So I'm sympathetic to everybody, and I don't play as much favorites on the history. I obviously live in Serbia, which is a statement, and my views of the geopolitics would tend to line up the ways that are going to become obvious in this talk. But I want to first say that this is not about a wrong people or a right people. This is not about a people who belong somewhere and who don't belong somewhere. This is all a historical mess of processes beyond anyone living control today. We've inherited this from the past. Okay.
That's a great background, because this is a lot of, this is a lot of stuff that I certainly didn't know, a lot of this stuff. And it is a good way to start this conversation, to give a quick and dirty overview of, the history of all of this, and remind everybody that, yeah, it is, we are all a lot closer to each other than we would like to believe. And this, we have cultural differences across the United States that would be potentially greater, right?
Right,
You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
when you think about Louisiana is still under French law, right? As
Right,
opposed to the
right.
rest of the country, right? I mean, so there's like, we
Yes.
don't have, we don't have, we even have weird things like that. We still have Native American, enclaves in, we call them reservations, but they're really
Right,
just,
right, right.
Open air prisons, right?
Right.
So it's never, nothing is ever as simple as the current lines drawn, the political lines drawn on a map,
Right,
and then a group
exactly.
claiming ownership over that particular geography. It's always a much
Right.
more messy
And what's
things.
interesting, I mean, even though, Serbs are much more ethnically, historically, at least by the language group, related to Bulgarians and Croats, et cetera, Slavonic language speakers. But what's interesting is that in Albania's, one of Albania's formative, in the more recent history, going back, 500, 600 years, that's the recent history of these great peoples that go back thousands of years, like the Serbs, like the Albanians. There was one of their leaders, Iskanderbeg, and he was like both Albanian and Serbian, right? And openly so. And so it's interesting that it would be nice to see, in some future world, like things, people like that again. You know what I mean? So I don't see it happening soon, realistically. But what happened in the in World War I, there was more population movement and things like that. And as you know, you had policies in this time whether you're talking the Greeks did it, the Ottomans did it, the Germans did it. You have population swaps, population moves, and those are very sanitary ways of talking about, you know, ethnic cleansing, right?
Right.
So it looks like the Serbs, Serbs have their receipts to show that they were there first. Albanians have their receipts to show that they were there first. Okay. It's like very similar to with Israel and Palestine and what's the status of Jerusalem. You know what I mean? It's kind of like at that level, and people experience it that passionately. That's why you have to talk about it this way too.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think that's good because it reminds us that we're all people with legitimate rights and interests.
Right.
And for me, it all boils down to individual property rights, right? Whether you're talking about the right of return anywhere is not about collective identities. There's never a we. It's always about who my father was and what I was left with. You see what I mean?
Right.
And so in no iteration, no solutions should anyone be deprived of that. And that's kind of those are my red lines, you see. So,
no, which are good red lines from my perspective, which are good red lines to have. Because
those are good.
Historically, this is the best way to resolve a lot of these things is to get down on, sadly. But we live in a world, unfortunately, soon not to be, if they have any control over this, the Bismarckian nation state, right? So yeah, we're moving story. Away from that, but we're moving to something far worse.
Right. So. That's the thing. Right. And many of the arguments about why we should move away from that are good, but then many of the realities they want to substitute it with are like catastrophic. It's like out of the frying pan into the fire, right?
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. I got
truly
you.
Truly is that.
So, yeah. And that's a good one. No, thank you. So we have like, then what happens is in the Tito period, so now you have World War II, okay? Mm-hmm. Then you have you have the communist state of Albania rise, which is, and I call it a communist state because he's much more like the kind of people that would become like in South Asia, like Pol Pot,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, like the Khmer Rouge, right? That's the Albanian version of communism. When the communists came to power in Yugoslavia, they wanted to do something more like a mixed economy and something more like East meets West. In some ways, you can say, some people call it, you know, friendly fascism with a democratic face or something like that. I mean, it was kind of like a corporatist system, and everyone wanted a Yugoslav passport because you could live in England, you could move to Germany, you could travel anywhere and go back to Yugoslavia. And they didn't have an immigration problem, because it actually was a very market type economy in many ways, that people could dynamically find work and et cetera. So it was a growing economy. Companies like the German Siemens actually found that they had way better production facilities, technical experience and technique in Yugoslavia, in Serbia. Mm-hmm. And so Tito seemed to have been in competition. Tito might have had ambitions to conquer Albania or to take over Albania.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But one of the things that was interesting is that he was committed to reversing the wrongs that Albanians felt were historical wrongs, and then started a process of repopulating Kosovo with more and more Albanians. Mm. It's unclear to me whether this was based upon what we talked about, like individual property rights, right of return, or whether this was just like, okay, now any Albanian who's never been to Kosovo before, come on down if you're ready to move or something like that. So I don't really know how that went down. I don't know who could prove that or, you know, what resource would be good for follow-up for folks, but that's what happened. And so, so during communist times in Yugoslavia, Kosovo became repopulated in a stronger way, where the balance now is where you see it today. It had been more evenly populated, like Serbs and Albanians, for a long time. But what the thing that was very interesting is that Albanians really wanted to move to Kosovo as much as possible because it could be part of Yugoslavia's dynamic quasi-market economy, as opposed to the Pol Pot, you know, Khmer Rouge shit happening, excuse my French, in Albania. So
no excusing foul language on this podcast. Let's get that really fucking clear, now.
Okay. And so you have like you have this mess develop kind of like pretty clearly in this time. And but remember that despite what Tito did, he was still contained by Yugoslavia's constitution, which didn't privilege any religion, didn't privilege any ethnicity per se, like as policy. And there wasn't really like strong tensions within the system, because tensions kind of come when people are hungry. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying that there weren't problems potentially. Clearly, those all came to light. But everyone in Yugoslavia in communist times, the salary was basically like this. Like every month, people had enough extra money to buy a television. Was the average salary,
Wow.
right? And you know how much TVs cost back in the 60s and 70s relative to today, right? They were still $500 in, you know,
Right. And I,
1970 dollars, right?
exactly.
So so there was many Albanians moving to Kosovo, in fact, and questionable how many could really establish, you know. And I can make a similar, like, I'm Mexican American, and my family goes back to Northern Mexico, Texas, New Mexico, and California since before it was United States, since before 1848. So I can relate to this concept the Albanians are having, totally, right? But we also know that even though there was the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which should allow those Mexican populations, indigenous, and had been in kind of what do you call like seasonal migratory patterns based upon food growth, right? That had always been circulating between northern Mexico and this America, what is now the American Southwest. That's very different from Mexicans from the very south of Mexico, who or you know who are moving to the United States in the 1980s because of economic disruptions specific to the time and place and the region, right?
Yeah,
And so that
absolutely.
might be also like what we see like with the Albanians moving to Kosovo. So it wasn't like everyone that moved to Kosovo was once a Kosovo Albanian.
Sure.
So, which doesn't make it any less or more legitimate. I'm just kind of giving some facts for people, right?
Right.
Like,
It's just a way of providing some context as to,
yes.
you have an economic and social incentive for people to want to move into that area because of the policies of Tito, and then
Right.
that sets the thing in motion, and then
Right.
you have a spectrum of behavior
Right.
coming from Albanians taking
Right.
advantage of the situation, either for
Right. I
historical
mean, game
purposes
theory. I
or
mean, but
otherwise.
very, very rational decisions. You know, we're
Absolutely.
not, there's no crazy Albanians in the story at this
No,
time, right?
absolutely.
It's
This
all,
is
it's
all,
all, right,
yeah.
right.
This is all just normal. These are just normal incentives that
Right.
people respond to, right? They're not
Right,
even
right, right.
perverse
Decent,
for
yes,
once.
decent, good, whatever people just living their life and following the logic of life and shit. So what happens then though is that in the late 1970s, Tito had kind of seems to have always made an agreement that after he was gone, he was going to leave it to the West to kind of sort the fate, okay? Because he had been really not committed to, you know, the Russian project. That was very, very clear, right? And or the Soviet project. And even though during the Tito period, which is all of Yugoslavia except for the last like 9 years of it, okay, so from the end of World War II until whatever he died in 80, 81, 82, whatever it was like Tito. But he never named a successor. He never built up, he ne there was no individual like him that was younger in the party that he groomed to provide the stability and unity that he did. And so if you don't do that, it looks very intentional. And we also know in the late 70s, there was a Club of Rome meeting where they looked at what to do with post Tito Yugoslavia, and it looks like, you know, everyone between the Gladio agents to the Vatican to the, you know, Western intelligence agencies were then really getting in to the soft power stuff, building up different promoting different types of musicians whose words were cryptically overlooked by the federal Yugoslav authorities, and until it was too late. And then it realized that through culture and through these things, that by the 80s, it was a tinderbox of you know, spiraling out of control. And the ethnic tensions were rising and rising, poked by these foreign powers that were pointing to real existing things on the ground, though, of course, right? Mm-hmm. It's a combination of those things. And now the thing that appears to have been, it was during the Clinton years that all of these things kind of came to a crashing explosion or whatever that we see. And for that reason, you know, in Albania and in Kosovo, you have like statues to, you know, all of these people that we would be like, why would they build statues to Bill Clinton? And why do they have the Hillary Clinton, you know, municipal library? And why do they have the, you know, why does General Petraeus own all of the cellular companies in Kosovo? And why does Madeleine Albright people own the infrastructure in Kosovo and Albania, right?
Right.
And so it's definitely that like that Roman Empire senatorial system where after you, you know, conquer a country, then you, you know, kind of own the latifundia there, right? That's what's the point, right? So this is what seems to have happened. And so basically sovereignty of Kosovo was transferred from Serbia to, you know, whatever you want to call that, the British Empire, the American cabal, whatever.
The Clintons.
The Clintons. I mean, specifically the Clintons is actually a very clear and specific title of transfer and transfer of title. And that kind of looks like what happened. And but they were telling, kind of similar to with Ukraine, like Ukraine might believe that they're in some fight for sovereignty, but that looks like that sovereignty question went out the window when they sold it all off to BlackRock, Vanguard, blah, 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 right? I mean, it's kind of like, what did they do? What did they do?
I've been saying this for a while now, and I get a lot of pushback on it. I'm like, was Ukraine ever really a sovereign country?
Right, that's the question.
I mean, going back to the 90s, like, no, seriously, it's never really been a sovereign country. It was
not really
recognized by a lot of people as being sovereign for their reasons, but but it never operated as a sovereign country. And and all arguments about, you know, international law and invasion. And all, I'm sorry, I've had too many an argument with even my good friend and partner Dexter White about this, and I'm just like, dude, I just don't buy that argument. I just never have. And that's part of the reason why I can understand why this situation looks the way it does. And so let's move forward to today.
Sure.
What's very important, we're going to glance over the bombing of NATO in 1999, but I think we know that this is all, I think, if I'm correct in this, that this is all now a setup for a NATO operation to blow Serbia apart, because In my way of thinking, this, as the Soviet Union retreats, and now in order to start the process of rolling up Eastern Europe, and in the Mackinder sense, the heartland,
that's right,
Eastern Europe, in order to go after Russia, you have to destroy all contact and all political control of that entire region.
Exactly right. Yeah, you would have, based on of Mackinder, you would have the development, like the synthesis or the innovation from Mackinder, from Spykman or Speakman, mm-hmm. and Spykman is the one who develops Rimland. And so clearly, like Yugoslavia and this read the Balkans all the way through the Middle East, etc., is part of Rimland. And Rimland's supposed to contain Heartland, as you said, Mackinder's theory of Heartland. So this is like Spykman or Speakman's theory of Rimland, how to contain Mackinder's theory of Heartland, right? Mm-hmm. So very interesting stuff. And that's what's happening. That's actually the grand chessboard stuff that, in many ways, if you look at the whole picture, then you, when it comes down to the particular claims of ethnicities, you're kind of like, you know, you're right. That's why it's either like all, or that's why I put it down to individual property rights, by the way, because you're never going to get a good collective answer from this problem, typically speaking. So it's really a tragedy too. I can't underscore that. And there's, it's not about wrong people once again. So yeah. So fast forward to basically the present scenario is that you've got what's remained from the Tito's policy, and what modern, you know, Serbia is as a rump state of Yugoslavia, but it's also the successor state. And Belgrade was the capital of Yugoslavia and of Serbia. You see what I'm saying? So, I mean, Serbia today, their economy makes up 60% of the economy of all of the Western Balkans, right? And yet it's the country that's not controlled by the EU or NATO. So Serbia is like the crown jewel of the Balkans. You can't say you control the Balkans if you don't control Belgrade. And whether that's a status thing or a pissing contest or a real geopolitical thing, all kind of seems to be merging in this reality we live in, where a lot of these things that people seem to be grasping at seem to be decreasingly based upon the theories that may have applied 100 years ago, back under Spykman, and more upon other things that are open to anyone's interpretation, but they're not as rational as some of these things appeared to be in the 1880s or 1910, right? I mean, it's when you think about drones, when you think about, natural barriers are not as significant as they used to be in warfare and things like that. So lots of big questions arise there naturally, Tom. But yeah, getting on track and moving forward with what happens is like you what is happening is that people know that in 99 that the US directly intervened. And the reason that Belgrade was bombed wasn't just because of the whole war in the Balkans, but it was over Kosovo. And then and the Russians came in and they tried to basically mitigate the outcome, which they succeeded to do. Putin actually basically comes to power right at that moment as Belgrade begins to be bombed. Okay, this is all happening at the same time. Yeltsin's in power. He does nothing about the as bombing of Belgrade. The Russians are like, this has got to be our red line. Whatever kind of hermetically sealed deep state in the neutral sense out of the KGB that existed, that was kind of finding their place to kind of where they're going to make their move or when they had to make their move to deal with this sovereignty issue that Yeltsin introduces, right? When Belgrade is bombed, that appears to be the red line. So that was beginning in like April through June or something like that. And so it was 70 something days. It was called Operation Anvil. And maybe numbers estimate between 5 and 25,000 Serbian civilians were killed in that bombing over 70 something days, consecutive days of bombing, right? Not like once in a while. So tremendous thing happens there. And Putin is already in charge of this newly formed organization called the FSB. And but then positions himself there to operate and conduct the foreign operations, and and so while Yeltsin is nominally still in power for just a few more months, actually, Putin is actually in charge, and they get the Russian paratroopers in there. They land at the air base. They have the whole thing. There was almost a shooting between Russians and Americans that. No, oh, that would never happen. Well, now we see the war in Ukraine that actually you can see, but yeah, that was a big thing then. And as a consequence of the Russian intervention, the and what and how the thing was resolved, the Russians came at the very, very last minute to balance this thing. We get the UN Security Council Resolution 1244, which basically tries to meet everyone's needs, and that's the again, and it's how you want to treat the UN or international law or whatever is all about which arguments kind of work for you. I totally get that. But if you want to talk about the difference between international law versus a rules-based system or a rules-based order, then international law becomes a lot friendlier. And I'll say what I mean, for example, with let's say people might relate to the lockdowns and, right? And people say, well, there's a difference between law and mandate, or the difference between law and recommendation or voluntary mandatory or whatever the fuck, so people can appreciate that difference. And so I only compare international law, UN Security Council stuff to what it's being posed against in reality today, which is the fiat or tyranny of just the rules-based order, only one side saying what the rule should be instead of it being the product of what keeps the world from blowing up. So that's kind of like where it is. And so 1244 basically says, okay, the Serbs need to give way, way more autonomy to Serbia. They have to pull out the military. There can be no more Serbian forces of any kind in Kosovo. Okay. The Kosovo can be an independent, there's going to be a temporary administration in Pristina. KFOR is going to come in and hold the peace. for like a couple years, and like not for, you know, since be, you know, probably 25. Half of your audience was born, right? Yeah. Right. So you've got like, so totally it's way beyond its mandate right today. And because of what was actually envisioned in 1244 and what actually everyone agreed to, and that's what matters. Contract is what you can consider this actually. Right. Okay. And contract is law. And what they agreed to, it included elements of the Ramillies Agreement, but not the fact that Kosovo is an independent country in terms of the UN. It's supposed to be an autonomous republic inside of Serbia, and with, quote, the greatest amount of autonomy, or even more beyond other models that we've seen historically, but still part of Serbia. Mm-hmm. Okay. And which means that they regulate themselves internally, right? But you can't have a permanent foreign military base that's a member of an alliance that you're not part of on that territory. So it actually all boils down to, will you have NATO bases there?
Right.
Right. Where are we seeing that problem again today?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Ukraine. Actually, yes. So everyone agreed that Kosovo is a majority Albania country, ethnically, that they have a right to self-determination as a people, that sure. they voted in multiple referendums for that independence.
Right.
Okay. But it also boils down to questions about, and I don't like comparisons of people to children, but this is actually, when you look at the history of the 19th century and how the conversations and the diplomacy and the letters between the Russians, the Turks, and the British, between the 18-teens and the 1840s and 50s, when like Bulgaria, Greece, and Serbia all gained independence from the Ottoman Empire, and that was like negotiated both by the British and the Russians with the Ottomans.
Right.
Like the thinking, they were acting like the, like in loco parentis, they were acting like the parents, and they were looking at the questions of like, what's in the interest of the offspring kind of stuff. Right. So think about it in terms of a divorce with Kosovo, and the father is Serbian and the mother is Albania. Okay. The children have the mother's surname. They grew up with the mother primarily, but they grew up in the father's household, in the father's house, in a part of the house that he never goes to. Right. So they grew up in the father's house, but with the mother's family members. Right. But when the judge looks at like, okay, who can provide the best. Right. And we're going to prove this by the numbers and by the demographics and who's moving where today, right now, who can provide the best. Right. And so even though, yes, like Albanians, want more autonomy, they had plenty, they can have plenty more, that's fine. But you can't put them with the mother, because the mother is not fit, and right. the mother does not have a job. Okay. And the father does have a job. And in fact, his job is 60% of the entire economy of the Western Balkans. Okay. So, and the other question is, were Albanians trying to move to Kosovo, or were Kosovoans trying to move to Albania? Well, right. And then if you are in now that Kosovo is no longer benefiting from Serbia's economy, where, and since all Kosovo people, according to all Kosovo Albanians, according to the Serbian constitution, are also Serbian citizens, which they still have, and they use that. Mm. So where are Kosovo Albanians moving today? They are moving further into Serbia. They don't want to be in Kosovo. They want to move into Serbia. Okay. Now, if you are an Albanian and in the EU or whatever, like, where do you want to move? Right. You want to move to England or Germany.
Right.
Okay. So both Kosovo. So the Albanians, not because of any inherent feature of their culture, but because of how they've been ensnared by these foreign powers, the British, the NATO, the EU, et cetera. On these economic policies, which the EU uses all over Poland and Bulgaria. And that's why you have in Germany, you have all these Bulgarians and Poles, et cetera. Right. And so these things, the EU policies don't work. But it looked like the strategic policy was a population growth policy. Like the the for what it's worth, the American strategists, we can, you know, talk, obviously we're just talking about people who are the American in the American policy, the strategists were pursuing a greater Albania policy. But the thing is that you need population growth to both support and justify and utilize territory, right? Like, right. you have to have a Lebensraum problem in order to have right. to get Lebensraum, right? Okay, so Albania doesn't have a Lebensraum problem. They actually have an EU problem. They have a City of London problem. And so they're actually being pulled, and those are, I understand, distinct things, but they're being pulled into Northwestern Europe, okay? Yeah. But the strategy for Greater Albania hinged upon population growth. But European Union policy doesn't allow for population growth.
Right. Right. So, no, it's hostile. So, if anything, it's hostile to population growth and is sympathetic to killing off as many human beings as possible.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I don't want to get myself into too much trouble here. So I don't want to get myself into too much trouble here, but yes, clearly they have a depopulation agenda. That's
yeah, it's a population. Yeah, it's a depopulation agenda, and it's not one that Serbia has. Like Serbia has a pronatal agenda, right? You see, like in Serbia, they're giving, $2,000, which is about half a year's salary for many people for the first child, like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 for the second and third, etc. I mean, if this
similar
is a country
policies where, of what Putin has enacted over in Russia.
Right, right, exactly. So in a country where people make between $500 and $700 a month, like $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 is a lot of money, right?
Right, right.
In Albania, people are making like $300 a month or $200 a month. So that's the difference. People are making 2-3 times as much as in Kosovo or Albania overall. And those aren't always seen in the numbers because GDP is average as opposed to median and whatever. Albanian oligarchs do kind of skew some of those figures in weird ways. Wealth distribution in Albania is far more skewed than it is in Serbia. Okay.
Sure.
So all these numbers kind of matter. And so that's why if we're seeing any signs of a shift in U.S. policy with this question, yes, it could be a strategic ruse. Yes, it could be a cool your jets because we're losing in Ukraine, or we don't know what's going to happen in Ukraine, or we're not winning fast enough in Ukraine. Take your pick. Mm-hmm. Or it could be just to get the Russians to relax about things and not push now. It might be a sign that maybe the Russians could or would push now. This fact that the Americans are kind of playing nice with what had just happened, and we're going to obviously give the what happened
so,
just
context
a moment.
Right? Yeah, this is what I really wanted to talk about today. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's what we're here for. But just so people kind of know what has happened to the moment where the shit's popping off.
Right.
And, you know, the kind of the background of the policies and the intrigues and the population and stuff like that. During the Trump administration, they came to an agreement with the Kosovo and Albania and Serbia that Kosovo would not pursue recognition in international organizations. And that Serbia could start to build more settlements in Kosovo for Serbs to move there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I saw language reminiscent of this in Blinken's statement and from people beneath Blinken who operate in the region. And I thought that was totally weird. And I'm still working out, you know, what's
going
on.
Yeah, no, that is really weird. Because, right.
Like
because
I said, it
I, well, this
be
is
rude.
The interesting, and this yeah. is where I want to go to this. So, yeah. so I have, like I said at the outbreak, the outset, I have, you know, I have Serbian patrons who have tried to, you know, give me the nuanced look at what just happened. So we had this big incident between Serbs and KFOR
right.
and NATO forces, right, in Kosovo recently, where the Serbs, unarmed Serbs just stood up to NATO, armed NATO forces that
right.
were advertised to be Hungarian and Italian when
right.
we saw the 101st Airborne Division patches
That's
on
right.
these guys' arms. And so,
right. We saw National Guard. I think the one, I did report it that way. And then I was reminded again, right, when the patch is on the right arm, that means that they previously served So these would have been National Guard, previously 101st Airborne.
Oh, okay.
But yes,
fair enough.
So there's no doubt that they're American troops there. Right?
That's the big one. And yeah. I think that the way it was described to me, and again, I'm just passing this along.
Right.
You can interpret this however you want. Tell me it's a good analysis or a bad one, which is that the Americans were betting that with their presence there, the Serbs would not actually fight back because Americans were there, and they're
correct.
And then when that happened and they started picking up rifles and that's when everything went, we're not in Kansas anymore.
Oh, not in Kansas. No, absolutely, man. It's like, I mean, for a long time, the K4 vehicles, the Humvees and stuff like that are painted with American flags just to intimidate the Serbs. But it's really weird because if you look up close at those painted American flags, they look like the way, you know, like the Mexican ice cream trucks, how they like get Donald Duck looking kind of wrong and it looks like cheap paint and stuff. Like they look like Mexican ice cream truck versions of the American flag on these K4 vehicles. And the guys are in uniforms with American patches sometimes, but they're not wearing the uniforms, like their BDUs are not at all American, or their whole is everything wrong. So it's weird. And but yeah, there's that whole American force projection thing that so what happens is basically there's an agreement going back to April 2013 on normalization. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is this. The Serbian constitution, which still exists, says that Kosovo is part of Serbia, right? And Vucic cannot, will not, should not, for that reason and because of democratic reasons, like he would lose any next election, right? Is not giving up Kosovo, de jure,
right.
Okay? But where people get confused is they think that Vucic is responsible for the de facto situation, when this is because there's been a U.S. military base in Kosovo since 2000, and Vucic doesn't come onto the scene until, just 10 years ago.
Right.
So it's like, it's not like he invited the war right. I mean, he was a young man. He was 20 years old or 30 years old at the time. Right. So anyway,
yeah, it is a weird thing. It's like, and you know, when you're dealing with, it's funny when you're dealing with a diaspora of any form, doesn't matter who it is. When India Pakistan flares up, you see it. It just, you see it. It's always worse from the diaspora than it is from the natives. And same thing over Ukraine and Russia. Same thing with the Serbs. Same thing. It just, you see it over and over and over again. So we as outside observers, or we as not just outside observers, but we as supposedly objective observers, have to remember that when we do our analysis of what's going on. So this is again, and to your point earlier about, this is not to take anyone's side here. This is to understand that there's a reason why y'all are diaspora. You don't want to be there. I get it. Like you're angry. It's the same thing. Like my family left Italy 100 years ago in order to get away from fascism. And then we went back and fought, had to go back and fight Mussolini. Right.
Right. So like that. Exactly. So this is very similar in terms of how diaspora populations react. And, mm-hmm. It inflames passions. And I try to just focus it in a more laser, what are the facts? What is the reality kind of approach that looks at human beings as everyone is equal in dignity and respect and rights and humanity and all the love and that goes with it, man. Believe me, it's all good. Right. So so there's two different realities. Okay. And people misunderstand, therefore, what that when the Europeans are pushing for is for Kosovo to be recognized at the UN. Okay. Mm-hmm. What the Serbian government is pushing for is to fulfill 1244 and the subsequent agreements within the confines of 1244, such as April 2013, which calls for which reaffirms, number one, the need to normalize the situation. Normalization just means that you're not having K4 there. Normalization, it's not normal to have an international foreign brigade in your country. Like that's not normal. Okay. So normalization means that Kosovo completely autonomously without any Serbian interference is the government of Kosovo. But international treaties on matter of military have to be signed off by Belgrade. That's the only difference between these two visions. And that's what all this shit is about. Okay, there's no agenda by Serbia to remove Albanians from Kosovo. There's no agenda to deprive them of property, personal or collective national ethnic rights at all. In fact, many people have rightly pointed out that Serbia's very liberal policies in the past led up to the situation that we have now.
Right.
So
it's kind of the reverse of the Donbass.
Kind of like the reverse of the Donbass.
With basically. The Minsk agreements.
Yes.
Acting as UN Resolution 1244 as this thing that will never be resolved.
Right. Exactly. It's this thing that's never going to be resolved. And yeah, Minsk agreement resulted in fucking 2202, which also very similar, the Ukrainian side did not fulfill. And
right.
Likewise with this one, Albanian or the Kosovo side, because they're being pressured by these Brussels and British, et cetera, authorities. I mean, the British influence in the Balkans goes back. I mean, we've established that already. So they don't just give away assets that they've established. Like no one does. Okay. It's like so many nickels and quarters in your pockets, Don Corleone, you know? So you just don't give them away. Right. So, what happens next then is, because of that, both Serbs in the country and Serbs in the diaspora misunderstand what the Serbian government says when they talk about normalization. We have then this 1244, and everyone agrees that that should work out. And actually, even the people who became the government in Kosovo were the ones who agreed with that. Okay. Anyone else more radical couldn't have achieved anything because they wouldn't be operating within this kind of custody agreement that the brand new Putin and the Americans basically had to figure out how to resolve this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what we have today is a product of that. And what the Kosovo side or the Pristina authorities rather have been trying to do, because Kosovo's in Serbia. So what's the Kosovo side? All right. What the Pristina authorities have been trying to do, right, is to present a picture to the world and to themselves that Serbia is doing something wrong, or that Serbia has broken some agreement, or Serbia is not adhering to something, when all of this is Pristina pushing the envelope beyond agreement. So they're breaking contract, basically. Right. And contract says what it says, but they moved on in 2008. Contract was established 22 years ago, 23 years ago. They move on and declare independence in 2008. UN does not recognize it, still does not.
Right.
Okay. So their international law says it's part of Serbia. India, China, Brazil, Mexico, populations representing, not that it matters, but if people are interested where the kind of whatever the gestalt, whatever the vibrations in the world are, mm-hmm. they're pretty much split even on this. But by population, it goes on the Serbian side. But about 100 countries recognize Kosovo from the General Assembly, and about 97 countries do not, or something like that.
Right.
It goes back and forth. Sometimes you're able to get a new government in, Zambia or something, and then they switch sides. And
right.
So it's not going anywhere. And what happens is the most recent thing that happens is Pristina is trying to continue with their version of things that's outside of the agreements. And the agreement was to establish an autonomous Serbian municipality governance for the Serbian enclaves of the ethnic Serbs who haven't been ethnically cleansed yet, there in Kosovo. And instead of abiding by that, the present government is probably even emboldened in the current thinking that, well, now that everyone in Europe is clear about Zelensky you know, must speak at Eurovision or whatever, or must, you know, now that we're clear that Zelensky is our best friend, why don't we try to get, you know, Kurti to be like, you know, why don't we start to include Kosovo into this? And also maybe the calculation is that, hey, if we're kind of losing steam or attention or vibrations on Ukraine, we can probably catch a lower hanging fruit thing and get Serbia into a thing there, right?
Oh, yeah,
because Serbia.
What I would say is it's very clear that every other provocation around the Russian underbelly, right, is resolving in a way. So Georgia, Nagorno-Karabakh, yes, all this other stuff. So they have to flare another one up. They're always looking some way to stretch Russia thinner because Russia is always the target here. That's the way I would.
Serbia is seen as another one of his, and this is actually a term. It's actually seen as another Malorussia. It's actually seen as another Little Russia. Right. And there's been civil society at the official level of even, you know, people like Malofiev and others who are, you know, NGO backers in Russia have been very clear about supporting initiatives like a union state between Serbia, Belarus, and Russia, for example. Right. I was invited to speak at a conference about that. We did that here in Belgrade 2016 or something like that. Different geopolitical analysts like myself I gave a fucking slideshow, blah, blah, blah. So that's a real thing. And PowerPoint was still a thing back then. Wow. Why the years? The years fly. but yeah, it's so they have the Pristina has been, look, again, I'm just saying the facts of the process. Like, if someone wants to argue that Albanians have the right to do that, that's like a different argument. Or like the moral imperative is like, that's a different argument. You know what I mean? And I'm sympathetic to all of these fuck the law, you know, what's really right approaches to life. Don't get me wrong. And
absolutely.
I have Albanian friends and I, you know what I mean? So it's like, I totally get what they're doing in their minds. But I don't know how many of them understand that this is like a story of the scorpion and the frog, and that the EU and the British are going to leave the fucking Albanians to dry, man. They are not. They do not care about Albanians.
They don't care about Albanians. Yeah, no, yes. Absolutely. And this is the issue. And what I find really interesting about this is that, and I understand that Vučić is a very complicated figure, depending on who you.
Right.
I've gotten that impression, but what I can see, I think he's done a remarkably good job of holding this thing together under unbelievable amounts of pressure.
That's right.
He continues to sign good solid infrastructure deals, you know, between rail and pipeline and energy supply deals, which are the key to continuing Belgrade's economic advantage over the rest of the Western Balkans. Because again, if you're going to assert your independence and assert your autonomy and your sovereignty, you do so by being the big economic power in the room. And so it makes sense. And then, of course, you know, bordering Hungary and then creating that, you know, you're now looking at, because if you really start to think about what's happening in Ukraine, and again, nobody knows what's going to, you know, what the Russians, I still have this thing. I don't, until I see from the Russians the ability to do combined arms operations in a way that one would expect from the quote unquote second big, most powerful army in the world, then you can't say that they're going to be able to take much more territory than they currently have. Then you can look at a geographic map, a topo map of Ukraine and figure out just where the Russians can force project.
Right. So, yeah. When I look at the number of like mostly armored vehicles and drones and things like that. I mean the big drones, not the little drones, but the big, big drones, military grade drones and armored vehicles and things like that they're destroying. And I also look at the demographics of who's doing the dying on the Ukrainian side. Mm-hmm. Like, is it guys who they're rounding up off the streets, or is it guys from the Kraken division, you know? And right. I'm hoping, you know, more guys from the Kraken division and no more regular Ukrainians who, you know, right, should be with their families and living life. So
right.
It's like because they don't want to be there. I'm not saying what they should be doing. I mean,
right.
Anyone who I totally get Ukrainians have every right to fight the Russians right now. Like, right. Don't get me wrong. Like, okay. So, yeah, it's on Russia to win if they're going to win or whatever. Right. And like
or
you're saying,
what the, or what the definition of winning for Russia is. This is one of the arguments.
They've been very vague about that. And I think that's kind of a strategic ambiguity on their part because it gives them a lot of wiggle room and they can declare victory in about four or five different iterations regardless. So it's, you know, they
that's one way of looking at it. I think and I'm not saying that you're wrong about that. What I'm saying is. And I'm just going to, this is where I get to push back a little bit because this is where I get to go, okay, let's play with this again. I honestly believe when I back this out to the bigger picture, which is to the other theaters, not just the warfare, not just the physical kinetic warfare, but the financial war, the cultural war, and the political war, the diplomatic war. This is where I think their longer term, the attrition strategy works to their advantage. And that's what I think they're trying to declare victory. Like the Russians win by drawing this out and by drawing as much NATO material into their sphere where they are strong so that they can just...
Time is on their side.
Yeah, no, and they can just bomb it. Artillery shells are cheap, right?
Right.
You know, drones are cheap. And the support structures for the Ukrainian military that we're now having to pour in there are far more expensive.
That's right. And that's what it is.
And time politically is on their side. And they know that the way you beat the West is... the fact that they're not, that the people are not committed to the globalist leadership's plans. And therefore, all you have to do is drag this out. And if the Ukrainians want to continue to throw guys in there, from the Russian standpoint, it's like, well, we can't stop you from doing it. It's dumb. Right. You shouldn't, but you're going to. Okay, then this is what we're going to do. And so I think that is the best description of what this war is at this point. And it actually makes me sick to listen to you describe the layout of the situation between Kosovo and Serbia, because it just looks like the same goddamn thing.
All over again. And that's the disaster we're trying to avert here. And I think that most people's criticism of Vucic involves many facts that are true. Okay. It's just sort of like one of the great tragedies in the world is having a good idea of all the problems are, but placing the wrong hierarchy of, you know, which problems are worse than others and which lead to others, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're a country with 7 or 8 million people like Serbia and you're not in the EU, but you still have to act like you want to get in the EU and you have, it's not North Korea, like everything is privatized in terms of industry and stuff. And you want to keep investors and you want to keep development. And you can't become a pariah state at the same time you have red lines about security and development and sovereignty rather that you can't give up. So it's like, you know, it's hard for people, and people kind of like there's something in the Serbian mentality that wants to resolve through diplomacy those things which they lost through war, and seldom does that happen. Now we might be living in a time when that could happen, which is interesting, but up until now it's been kind of silly to say like, why doesn't Serbia just get the army and retake Kosovo? It's like, well, you know, why don't we all just go move to fucking North Korea, you know, or become like Cuba then and just become a, you know, a pariah state. Hey, you know what? Good on you. Strong on you. Look, you're surviving. You know what I mean? Like, hey, they have the Cubans, the North Koreans have a lot to be proud of in some way, but at what cost?
Right.
You know,
but at what cost?
But at what cost? And is that cost really acceptable?
I don't know. It's a good question, and I think that we understand that this is one of the jewels that you grab Serbia, you now make it impossible for Hungary to resist any longer, and then you know the Russians' inability to frankly take Odessa, unless something happens radically that changes, you know, the. Unless something radically changes, I don't see the Russians taking Odessa and therefore opening up the path for Hungary to be connected to the East. Because it's very important. Like Hungary is landlocked. And so, you know, when you start to look at how how Yugoslavia has been carved up, it's in order to ensure that there is no path to the sea for Hungary and Serbia.
That's right. No, that's why Montenegro was broken off of Serbia too, because Serbia actually had, you know, the Adriatic. Serbia actually was a naval power until 2007, 2008. And that's when the whoever Western powers decided to back the Djukanovic mafia, Djukanovic dynasty, now to be in control of in Montenegro this whole time. I mean, this is a population of maybe 100,000 people through most of the year. On the census, it's 300,000 people, something maybe like that. Most of them live in Belgrade. And it's kind of like, it's basically Montenegro is a beach and summer home location of Serbia. And, just because in some time in the 12th or 15th century, you know, two princes that were Serbian had different backyards, you know, the Zeta or the versus the Principality of Serbia versus, you know, Zeta or whatever. That's not at all like, you know, Germany isn't, you know, nine different countries today or whatever, right?
So, right. It's not a justification. A 12th century claim to land is not a justification for making a new country.
That's right. And with the crisis, I hope people have seen this footage. It's for people who are anti-authoritarians, for people who don't like to see riot cops with their fucking lobster shell helmets and the shields and with attack rifles too, like dealing with crowds. Like people have never in their lives seen this footage. This is something that people have to go to YouTube or wherever they're going to Reddit or whatever and find this stuff because it's incredible. You never seen the armed riot police armed with guns. This is so crazy, being physically barefisted by the Serbs, like, yes, rolled out. And there's just footage of all these, I mean, dozens and dozens, and they're like rolling on the ground and they're not, others are knocked out. You're seeing bodies being dragged into backs of hospital wagons of these gendarmerie of the security forces.
Right.
And the Serbs are there just like with fists, and or they're grabbing the batons from the police. Yep. And they're breaking, they're smashing open the shields and then smashing the helmets off their heads. Yep. And then smashing their skulls under the helmets. If you thought these lobster tails couldn't be defeated, the Serbs showed you how to do it.
Yep.
Frankly. Yep.
I saw some of the footage and I was just shocked. I'm like, part of me was like, part of me was cheering clearly. And part of me was at the end of the day, sadly going, oh, now it's to this level. But
the American local KFOR commander also disclosed that American and KFOR soldiers were also shot.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And what he said is that the bullet, right, the bullets that they found based upon the forensic term for the
ballistics.
The ballistics, yes, but how the rifling leaves the imprint on the bullet.
Right.
Yeah. Proves to him that they were not weapons that were supposed to be were not in the KFOR arsenal. They were not in the KFOR arsenal. Okay. Which only means logically, if your eyes work, that it was the Albanian special forces that were brought in there with them.
Yes.
Okay. And that's why what happened was as soon as that happened, the Americans said, Kosovo is no longer participating in this drill that went live.
Yes. Oh,
maybe this is the more interesting thing, is that there was the European security, Europe Defender 23 drill happening involving Kosovo in Kosovo with 8,000 US troops in Kosovo and 17 or 18,000 EU troops in Kosovo at the time to stage European Defender 2023 while they're then deciding to take over the Serbian municipalities through force after a sham election that only had 3.4% voter participation. That's not right. Like, this is fucking crazy.
Right.
So I think this is the story that you wanted to hear. And this is actually what happened. And it's so the KFOR, the Kosovo Pristina leader, He basically uses the pretext of the drill and all these Americans here this is one iteration, okay?
Sure.
As a psychological operation to like leverage and muscle this into a direction that might even troll or pull or whatever the Americans into an action that they didn't want to have to take. Another version is that the Americans wanted to do this, but as soon as the things went the way they did, they realized it was a gross miscalculation, and then they separated themselves from what happened and blamed the local Pristina authorities for it.
Sure.
But what did look like what happened at a certain point, I mean, definitely the KFOR forces that were shot were by the Albanian snipers that were on the roofs. And it was actually the Serbs from the Serbian list and the activists that were having the peaceful protests that you saw them doing the sit-in, okay, because they were sitting cross-legged on the ground singing. They weren't throwing stones or anything, okay?
Right.
Like they were sitting on the – they were roadblocking the areas in front of the mayor's office that the Pristina authorities were trying to take over after having only had 3% participation from the local population.
Right.
So the Serbs are sitting there, a couple of hundred, maybe 1,000 on this area. And then, but the KFOR forces went to do the thing, the local Serbs said, hey, you guys are letting the ROSU, the Albanian special forces, you're letting them go in there too. Like, this is not okay. And like, just be aware that we see so that you know that I know that you know that I know that these Albanians right. are there with you, right? And so duly noted, and then the shit pops off and there's gunfire and, you know, two Serbs or one Serb is shot twice and multiple KFOR are shot. And there's no video ever anywhere of Serbs wrestling guns from, you know, anyone and shooting, right?
Right.
There's none of that. What you have is clearly the Albanian snipers that assume positions on a local school, on the mayor's office, on the other thing. Okay. And
yet another mysterious group of snipers shooting people on both sides.
Exactly. Just like we saw in the Maidan in 2014 in Kiev. So this is all very much like up our area of
yeah.
Of
and same thing. I think we saw the same thing in Belarus and Minsk, and it was the Belarus. Absolutely. It was somewhere else, or was it Armenia? Doesn't matter. What I've noticed, Joaquin, is that the whole color revolution thing doesn't work anymore.
It's running out of yes. My colleague at Strategic Culture Foundation, former Canadian ambassador to working within, I think was in the Soviet Union even, well, Patrick Armstrong, who you may mm-hmm. know. Anyway, he wrote a very compelling piece a year ago saying that the era of color revolutions is over.
Yeah. I've written stuff similar to that. I may have even riffed off of his work, but yes, I agree completely. There's only one's worked in the last 8 or 9 years, and that's Armenia and Pashinyan, and Armenia holds on to power by the skin of his teeth. And I think it's almost like Putin rather keep him there to make him an example to Armenians about what happens if you actually let this, you know what I mean? Like, we'll just keep this bad example of what an Armenian leader looks like so that,
right.
you know, Armenians don't get any uppity ideas. Like, we're going to keep this guy here and we're still going to keep Armenia under control.
Yeah, it's like when Albert Pike wrote that the French shouldn't have destroyed the Bastille, that they should have kept the Bastille to show, you know, what it was that
right,
what,
right,
what
right,
the
right.
issue was, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So okay, so it's really not as complicated as I thought. It's basically the same fucking rotten, perfidious Albion bullshit that we've seen 1,000 times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's like the thing is that it's like it's so strange how these things have, you know, rolled out. And I hope that the Pristina authorities are clear that, you know, they're expendable. Like if they saw if that second iteration, like the two versions, right? Like if it wasn't Kurti goosing it along and exploiting the fact that this drill was happening, but in fact it was a plan. You know, if it was a plan, you can see what happens if it doesn't go right. The shit rolls downhill. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like it's not going to land on Blinken, dude. It's going to land on Kurti.
Right. See? Right. In the same way that we betrayed the Kurds in eastern Syria, the same way that, you know, when they tried to reinstall Nazarbayev and Kazakhstan, exactly. and that failed, like all of this stuff. And it's like, you know, I look at this stuff today and I'm like, guys, GCHQ, seriously, you may be the best at this stuff, but you're not any good at it anymore, because it's actually harder to pull this off than because you are always able to pull this stuff off. But I got news for you. You were only able to pull it off because nobody could figure out what the fuck you were doing. Now everybody can see you in real time, and it's actually really ham-fisted and stupid. So would you please stop? But unfortunately,
it's like when you see those old, it's like when you see like an old movie, you know, like from the 40s or 50s, and now you're seeing it like in a HD, like 4K, like it's been whatever upgraded or whatever, right. And you're seeing it on a 50-inch screen, and you can see the fucking strings, and you can see everyone's makeup, and you can see the
right.
You know, you're like, wow, this didn't show like on real. This didn't show right. on little TVs back in the day, you know?
Right.
It's just like that. Now we can actually see all the stagecraft in real time. And it's totally weird. Like you're saying, it's totally ham-fisted. It's kayfabe.
And, yeah, you can really see that. Like, and I noticed this a few years ago, and it was so clear with their opposition to people like Trump and Brexit and all the rest of it. And then it's just gotten worse and worse and worse, because as you lose, they just keep doubling down on the same techniques because they don't have any other playbook.
And right, so, right. I mean, it's strange. I think the color revolution strategy, you know, and the techniques developed over a number of decades. And it makes me think that there might have been a time on the American project where it was more conducive to dynamic thinkers, or they were able to somehow get more smart people interested in working for them. And I think they might have even gotten to a point where they've gotten people that are just not that good. I think maybe the incentives or the beliefs are not there. People don't have confidence in it, and there's too many other opportunities for people that know how to do things.
Oh, how I mean, think of it this way: the dad makes the money, right? The son manages it, and the grandkids squander it, right?
Right. That's what it is.
That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that what I posted on my Twitter feed right before I went live with this is a beautiful little video of the G7 percentage of purchasing power GDP. It's like a little video of the change in time versus that of the BRICS and some of the rest of the global South. And it's this coming together of how color revolutions worked really well when seven countries control 70% of the world's GDP.
Right, exactly.
They don't work nearly as well when they control 35%.
Right, right. Yeah,
the incentives for other people to work with other people and to not betray their own interests are too strong.
Yes. Yeah, when my mentor, my security studies mentor, Dr. Michael J. Seiler, who was we all believe that he had been part of the Symbionese Liberation Army and had been, you know, pulled back in. He was like one of the guys involved in the kidnapping of Patty Hearst, and he escaped twice from Susanville. Right, maximum security. He escaped, and then they gave him like a whatever identity as Dr. Michael J. Seiler, and he's saying, hey, you want a letter if you want to join a 3-letter agency. Like, I would recommend you tomorrow. And I was like, I really appreciate that. No thanks. And he goes. Listen, he's a black guy, and he goes, listen. In my 20 years here at this institution, I think only 3 people have ever said no, and I've offered this only 10 times in my whole career. And it's like people don't want to do that. You know, it's like people don't want to do that. It's like, why? I don't want to be a hitman. I don't want to be a right. And I can see how these it didn't seem like appealing to me. It didn't seem I can imagine in the 80s or something that being appealing to someone to be a CIA guy.
Right.
I think they're losing the ability to retain and develop these ideas because there would be other strategies that they should be using that would be even more effective. And, you know, it wouldn't take that much to really devise these. And so it makes you wonder, like, where in the idiocracy chain of events we are in terms of these, you know, because, yeah, it's.
That's fine. No, I'm just laughing. I use the word idiocracy because it even extends to the intelligence agencies, and maybe
it's all you know. Remember thing. Dr. Lexis, you know,
right? You good? Oh yeah, we're getting bad rain in here now, so I'm gonna. I think this is a good place to stop, and we'll pick this up again another time in the future. But thank you, Joaquin, for that trip through history and the nuance on the subject. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so very much for having me on your show today, Tom. check out my my Telegram channel at New Resistance on Telegram. My Patreon is real easy. It's Joaquin F. Joaquin spelled like Joaquin Phoenix, but with an F instead of a PH. It's just Joaquin F. And you will find me on Patreon. And that's where I just have access to. I do every day, like about an hour to three, 5 or 6 days a week, talking about all these kinds of things, although in a much less structured and entertaining way than you'll find with Tom. But for folks that are really want to get into the nitty gritty and keep up with these kind of this drama and this stuff as it evolves, check out my Patreon, check out my Telegram. And thanks for having me with you today, Tom.
Appreciate it, Joaquin. You have a great day and enjoy the rest of your afternoon in Belgrade.
All right. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Well, that'll about wrap it up for episode 145 of the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast. I'm going to thank Joaquin for his time, his attention, and his expertise in these particular areas that we discussed today. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I really do appreciate it, as always. You can follow my work over at my blog at tomluongo.me. You can follow me on Twitter at TFL1728. And you can follow the work as well over at Patreon at patreon.com/goldgoatsandguns, where we do a monthly newsletter as well as regular market reports and bespoke research for my community. So you guys take care. You be well. We'll talk soon. And keep your stick on the ice.